Hello, and thank you for tuning in to Voices from Room. On this podcast, writers, poets, activists, artists, and analysts who have contributed to Room talk about their work, themselves, and the complex problems our world faces. Room is currently open for submissions for our next issue until May 1st. Please visit us online at analytic-room.com. My name is Isaac Sloan, and I'm joined by Aneta Stojnic. Hi, Aneta.
Hello, Isaac, and everyone who's listening. It is my great pleasure to introduce our guest today, Dr. Eugene Mahan, who is a training and supervising psychoanalyst at Columbia Psychoanalytic Center for Training and Research. He has published 4 books, Such Stuff as Dreams, A Psychoanalytic Odyssey, Ransel the Rabbit, and Bone Shop of the Heart, and numerous articles on psychoanalysis. Eugene has also authored the first poem that has ever been published in Room, which was for the first issue of Room, and the poem was titled The Theft Outright. Eugene immediately, upon publishing that poem, became Room's first poetry editor. He published many more poems in Room and several essays over the years, and he participated at Room's poetry salons and at our galas, and has been our really long-term friend and collaborator. In that vein, I would really like to start with your most recent contribution to Room, which is a poem titled Ratatouille Sonnet for Shelley Bach. I can imagine that it's difficult to write about a friend. It's difficult to write about a friend one is mourning. And I would like us to really start with that from this poem and where it came from. It comes from a long-term friendship between two analysts. So let's start from there.
Sure. The Ratatouille came from an actual conversation with Shelley. I think that part is factual, that he did eat ratatouille in Paris in 1945. He'd been a veteran in the war, as you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so that part refers to an actual event. The whole concept of ratatouille sounding like the firing of rifles, ratatouille, that was the poetic piece, I suppose. And I take that into his dreams and into his mind forever after, that there's no escaping that ratatouille sound, that knocking of the past that's always in our head, I suppose, particularly for those who've been in wartime and had to go through that incredible trauma, tragedy, experience of war. So that's basically what the poem is about, I would say, with an ending that's kind of moving, I think, where he says, would you like some of my ratatouille? And I say something like, yes, for all of the living, and yes, for all of the dead.
I said yes for all of the living and yes for all of the dead. Yeah, that's the exact line. It's a very moving line, and in a way, it's a very personal thing to write a poem to a friend about a friend. I don't know. Maybe you could. Would you want to say something about that process of writing this kind of a poem?
I mean, if the poem isn't personal, what is it, you know?
Yeah.
So I would say they're always personal, even when they sound impersonal. But I wanted to write a sonnet for Shelley.
Mm-hmm.
Why I got interested in sonnets in the last 10 years, I couldn't tell you, since I never wrote a sonnet before that or had any interest really in structure other than a kind of free associative poetic process. But when I did get to the sonnet, I was, that was a great challenge, that you'd have to put the most personal, emotional things into a structure. that had a certain kind of rhyme scheme. So that was a kind of discipline. But then you had to try to break all the rules of the discipline as you went along, or the poem would be a sing-song, sing-song, sing-song thing, you know, which is anathema, I think, for what you're trying to get across in the liveness of a poem, you know. Mm-hmm. If I may correct you about Renzel the red bit,
mm-hmm.
because you said Renzel the rabbit, and it's not a rabbit. It's an interesting choice of word there, because Renzel the red bit is a fairy tale in which I tried to depict child development, child analysis. So the storyline is this red bit, which is a very, very small animal, you have to imagine, a bit smaller than a rabbit. But he gets his name in a very interesting way. He's running through the green blades of grass, and onlookers say, "Oh, there's a red bit." So he's confused from the start with the kind of parapraxis where the eyes see what they think is a red bit of grass, but it's really this small animal who's running through the grass. I like that kind of way that you get your names in some crazy way, you know. What's in a name? A rose by any other name would smell as sweet. And that juxtaposition between the word, or even before the word came into life, the actual experience you had before you had a word for it, I think that's the excitement of poetry for me.
I think it touches on a quality that you bring to your writing in your poems and also your essay for Room. Your piece on playing for real in Room 219, you talk about the word serious, and it allows you to develop these streams of writing around this word that help you make your point. This is a kind of style of writing that I think is very psychoanalytic and also very particular to you.
I know something that I didn't ever want to write jargon. I was reading a terrific poem yesterday that I came across by chance. Maybe it's not by chance. Maybe it's in the poem a day. And there's a poem, believe it or not, by George Eliot, which was discovered in her late papers, maybe 1960 or something, but it must have been earlier, written earlier, obviously. But in that poem, she uses words like ego and self, and it's clear what she's trying to get across, that we get deeply invested in our jargon, you know, as if we knew what the self was or what the ego was. I mean, Freud was onto that when he said, "My mythologies," right? I don't know if you remember that passage in Freud, but he clearly realizes that all of the architectural structure that he's put together to try to describe the complexity of the unconscious mind or the mind in toto, that all of that was really kind of a mythology, that we didn't really have access to the agency of the mind the way the ego would try to seduce us into thinking that we do have. So I never wanted to write as if by accepting the jargon that one doesn't have to really try to write something that's more interesting than that, and maybe more real than that.
You're really touching upon something that I find very important, which is the relationship between psychoanalysis and art, and psychoanalysis and poetry as art, and how sometimes in a lot of, as you say, like jargonistic writing and academic writing these days, it gets lost. And it has been present in early writings, and especially in Freud, who is so poetic at times and so metaphorical. And so I think that you're really really touching upon that. And and I guess that kind of like probably brings us to my next question, which would be about the relationship between poetry and psychoanalysis for you, and kind of which I don't know if it's even a possible question to ask, like which one came first for you, psychoanalysis or poetry, and how does one inform the other?
Right, that's a great question. I've thought about it a lot. I don't know if you know the writing of Bronowski in The Imaginary Eye, I think is the title. But for him, he says, poetry and science are very similar. That the poet is trying to give a shape to the phenomenal world, just as the scientist is. I don't think we often put the two of them together, you know. The poet seems to be in his own world or her own world of fantasy. But I do think if you think about it seriously, psychoanalysis is trying to give shape to strange things like imagination, conflict, sexuality, aggression, ambition. And if we take all of those and say they're outside of science, as we know science to be something very hard-nosed, everything has to be studied under electron microscopy, as I like to say. But you can't put a dream under electron microscopy. And yet we'd have to say that a dream is a phenomenon. And surely it's as interesting as the periodic table, it seems to me, that there's magnesium or hydrogen, even though those are extraordinary things. But think about it poetically, the concept of water, when we say H2O, two molecules of hydrogen and a molecule of oxygen, it doesn't quite capture what water means to all of us. Water is something phenomenal, I think. Just imagining water or seeing water or being in water. I wrote recently something about the transference, that the transference could be considered as a metaphor in action. I kind of like that way of putting it, that the transference, if you think about it, I meet you, but I'm not really seeing you completely because I'm transferring onto you images from my father, my mother, my past. And that to me seems to be the magic of transference. An extraordinary discovery, I think, by Sigmund Freud. And somebody asked, which is the most important, the free association that he discovered or the transference? Luckily, we don't have to choose, right? But you see what I'm driving at there, that if the transference is a kind of metaphor in action, there isn't an awful lot of difference between psychoanalysis and poetry when you start thinking that way. Or free association, let's say. It's the most poetic thing of all, perhaps.
It is madness, but there is method to it. Comes to mind when you say that, and in a way that's what both analysts and poets do. Finding method in those dreamlike spaces.
And I think you also have to be surprised always. If you're not surprised as a psychoanalyst, I think you're falling into the trap of jargon, you know, the kind of I know everything, when we know nothing really. There's a beautiful poem by a woman writer, Lee Robinson, that begins, "What I know for sure is less and less. That a hot bath won't cure loneliness. That bacon is the best bad thing to chew. And what you love may kill you." And it goes on like that. But what I love about the first line is, "What I know for sure is less and less." She ends the poem with, "What I know is less and less. What I want is more and more. You against me, your ferocious tenderness, love like a star once small and far, now huge and near." So it goes from what I know for sure is less and less, but what I want is desire and love. And I think we would all agree on that. What we want is different from what we know. What was the question? I forget.
Does it still matter?
No, it doesn't matter. Poetry and psychoanalysis, I guess, is the question. What are the similarities? Yeah. I wrote a little poem not long ago that goes, writing poetry is like juggling words in the air. Two are easy. The third one is likely to get away from you. I once had a third word fall in my face and scar me for life, like childhood.
That's
I like that scarred me for life like childhood, because you're not expecting childhood to be thrown in there, I think.
That's a very psychoanalytic poem. That's a poem that if I didn't know, I would think that an analyst wrote it. Or somebody with a lot of experience in analysis.
Well, and it's also so playful. you know, play being another dimension of psychoanalysis, poetry, and something I know from your writing is very important to you.
I think child analysis kind of forces you to realize that, you know, because there's no other point of entry really with the child, a very young child, other than play. And of course, play is such an extraordinary thing. If you try to put psychoanalytic words on play, it's not that easy. Not that easy to define what it is, you know. I like what Freud said about play, that it's fantasy, but fantasy that needs to connect itself to the concrete world. You see, in adult analysis, we don't quite have to do that. We don't have to connect all fantasy in our minds to play objects. But if you think of play as needing, so certainly in childhood, play in adulthood, I guess, may be different, but play in childhood does require props. So the child needs to take the giraffe and fight, have the giraffe fight with the lion. And we then, as the analysts, are watching that drama unfolding. And we're trying to understand what aspect of the unconscious mind of the child is coming through in this type of playing. And it's deeply psychoanalytic, of course. And the psychoanalyst has to be pretty sophisticated, not to say too much, right? You can't say the giraffe is your father and the lion, you're the lion and you're trying to kill your father. Though sometimes I think the Kleinian approach comes close to that, where you can horse right in there and say whatever. But I'm of a different school, I think, in that sense. The Anna Freudian school would say you should come at the play very gingerly. Mm-hmm. And think of it as a series of displacements that the child is using, a bit like defense in that sense. And we don't always interpret defense. We almost at times corroborate the action of defense.
Yeah, I'm just thinking how that element of the play is so so important in work with adults as well, and how. I mean, in my own experience, how much working with children fundamentally informed my work with adults in a way that I tend to think about work with adults through the thoughts about a play and through the playfulness that comes out in the on the floor with children, with the giraffe and the lion, and kind of like, okay, what kind of like, what is going on here? What is this? What is going on between these giraffes and lions that are coming up in the material with an adult? And there is a certain kind of bravery, I think, that goes both into writing poetry and playing. One needs to have courage to go into the space of play. It's fun and it's playful, but it's also, you know, like as you said in your poem a minute ago, scarred for life by childhood. It's also fun and it's scary. Play is a complicated place.
Well, the psychoanalytic encounter, I think, between two people is terrifying. We pretend that it isn't because we get used to our certainties and our knowledge. But I do think the encounter between two people is always precarious, poetic. I think we tend to forget about that. Probably because we have the mastery of the free associative process, or we think we do. And it's the analysan who has to free associate and be brave. But we as analysts have to be brave also, I think. Right. And meet the free associations halfway.
Well, there's also something about the embodied state of play and listening. I'm thinking of Freud saying the analyst needs to tune the instrument of the unconscious to the patient. Poetry can be a kind of tuning experience in a bodily or embodied way, a kind of nourishing source for one's body and mind.
Yes. I was thinking of Yeats as you were talking, how as a young man his poetry is so romantic and delightful, really, you know. I went out to the hazel wood because a fire was in my head, and caught and peeled a hazel wand and hooked a berry to a thread. And when white moths were on the wing and moth-like stars were flickering out, I dropped the berry in a stream and caught a little silver trout. When I had lain it on the floor, I went to blow the fire aflame, but something rustled on the floor and someone called me by my name. It had become a glimmering girl with apple blossom in her hair, who called me by my name and ran and faded through the brightening air. And the last stanza is about looking for her and finding her. And later, he, as an older man, he writes a poetry that's suffused with death and how awful it is to age and be old. But he again says, but I never had an imagination more youthful or more extraordinary than I do have now as an old man. And I think that's true, right? The youthful excitement of Eros doesn't go away because your hair turns gray.
It's the libido, right?
Absolutely. Another piece of jargon that we have for something extraordinary, right?
Mm-hmm.
That we just barely know what it is, but we do know what it is. But what I know for sure is less and less. That's my guide.
I do want to turn to the more political poems you've contributed to Room. In a certain way, we're talking about the political nature of poetry all this time, but certainly with the formation of Room in 2016, there was a turn to the inclusion of poetry as a means of addressing politics that you were and still are very involved with.
As you spoke, I was thinking about Ashbery, and they asked him, why aren't your poems more political? And he said, poetry is over here, and politics is over here. So he had no intention of doing it that way. I'm also thinking of Edward Albee, when he was close to 9/11 when it happened. His house was down there. And they said to him, why did you not write immediately about the horrors of 9/11? And he said, that's not the way writing works for me. And I think that's true, you know, you don't just, writing is something different from experience the tragedy up front. That tragedy may influence you forever after, and I'm sure it will impinge on your writing. But you don't necessarily write a play called 9/11 that deals directly with the issue. That said, I do think there is something political about poetry. Because I think we can't get away from it. I don't know if you know Yeats's wonderful poem, 1916. It was written at the time, if you know your Irish history, and there's no reason for you to know your Irish history, but there's a lot of reason for me to know my Irish history. In 1916, Ireland, as you may remember, was a colonial country dominated by England for many centuries. And their desire to be independent in 1916 meant that a bunch of poets went and stormed the post office in Dublin and declared Ireland to be an independent nation. England made the extraordinary mistake, I think, of killing these poets by firing squad. And I think that created, in Yeats's term, a terrible beauty. He's talking about the people who died to try to gain independence. And he's questioning them, you know, were you crazy? He even uses the phrase, was it an excess of love that drove them to this passion for the independence of their country? In other words, can political power be almost too excessive? But he answers the question, I think, in a different way. He says, no matter what you think of all that, the names of these men lives on. A terrible beauty is born. And I think the concept of a terrible beauty is interesting for us to think in terms of politics, you know. But I'm not answering your question. I think you're getting to the idea that the last 8 years in America have been just so awful. And we saw the theft outright of a country by this maniacal force of fascism. And we all lived through that, damn it, you know. And seems to me something has to be said about that. And I think that's what you're referring to, Isaac. A poem like The Theft Outright.
Well, certainly, a number of your poems, The Theft Outright being in the first issue of Room, but also poems you've contributed like The President Tweets Like a Bird and Our Failure. These poems have taken on something of the moment and attempted to articulate something about, you know, what's going on.
It's difficult, I think, you see, because if you're going to think of the poem as a kind of free associative freedom, when you give the poem a task, like, please say something about Trump, please say something that can help us to live through the torment of this time, you can see what I'm driving at. It does kind of give you a mission, a topic. And the challenge then, I think, is to still try to make it poetic, you know, so that the poetry gives the political idea you're trying to get across a bit of power, you know.
I guess you might be also saying in that that a way to think about, or your way to think about political approach to poetry and writing poetry is to, as you say, to make it more poetic rather than to make it populist. That maybe when you say like somebody writing, you wouldn't write a poem that is dealing directly with the event or a political figure, like in a very literal, concrete way, which to my mind translates into populist approach to poetry, which exists as well.
Absolutely, yes. I mean, all those wonderful songs, you know, by Bob Dylan, they're very political, I would say, and yet mm-hmm. they're kind of marvelously poetic. I mean, it's not mm-hmm. for nothing that he won the prize, the Nobel Prize.
You know, like bringing up Bob Dylan, kind of like does make me think about another, I think, important question when it comes to poetry. At least it's something that interests me always, because of my theater and performance background and interest. Whether what do you think is the best medium for a poem?
Medium, by medium, you mean what?
By medium, are poems written to be read in silence from the paper, or are poems written to be listened to?
Yes.
That's something that I often think about. I thought about that a lot when I read poetry, you know, like kind of, it's different when you're sitting and reading a book on your own, and it's different when you have a poet read the poem themselves, or an actor on a stage recite a sonnet.
Mm-hmm. My mind goes to Plato, where
right,
you know, when they had the oral tradition, and how marvelous the Homeric, the Odyssey in spoken by these incredible bards or whatever they were. And when they started writing it down, I think somewhere I read that Plato was shocked, you know, the writing of it down is going to ruin the experience of this spoken word of the Odyssey and the Iliad. And I think maybe that's always there for us, you know, that one hears poetry spoken aloud somehow, that it is a drama and it needs to be spoken. And yet it is written down. And I think there's a discipline in getting it down on the page as well, you know. And I think the idea that the poem is only the cluster of words on the page. It's nothing more than that. And that order, Coleridge said, poetry is the right words in the right order, as opposed to prose being the right words in order. I never found that a satisfactory explanation of poetry, that poetry is the right words in the right order. But I do think the idea that the poem, once it's on the page, that's the beginning and the end of it. It only is that structure on the page. When we speak it, maybe we can speak it in different ways, and there's a drama in the way we present it orally.
I just want to mention that, as well as being a contributor to Room, you're also a poetry editor. And I wanted to ask about your experience of being an editor at Room and what it's meant for you to work with poetry in this editor role.
I've never thought of myself as a poetry editor, but I did get the job, so to speak. And it's wonderful, you know, because it forces you, reading a lot of poetry, it forces you to realize that there's good stuff and not such good stuff. And it isn't always easy to define what is it about this particular poem that leaps at you from the page and it really works and others don't. And I'm not so sure that I could pontificate about that, you know, as to how that's done. How do you know that a piece of art is really good? Somebody said something, I know what bad art is, but I'm not so sure I know what good art is, or something like that. It's hard to define. But yes, I liked it very much to have to read 50 poems and try to decide what's going on there. Why do certain poems not quite make it, whereas others are quite wonderful from the beginning? But it's hard, and I think there is a responsibility with editing. You know, you can't be a know-it-all who you can only kind of advise, I think, and say, look, I like this one very much for this reason. And of course, there are other editors, thank God, you know, so they agree or disagree. Usually you can get three readers arriving at the same position, and that's always reassuring, you know, that it isn't just my idiosyncrasy that's speaking, but others agree that this is a wonderful poem and this one isn't quite so wonderful.
And in a way, to bring it back to the kind of like relationship with psychoanalysis, in a way, and I guess that kind of like when one reads it as an editor, it kind of like becomes a bit different. But when one just reads poetry, it's always engaging, engaging of two minds. In a way, where the mind of the reader engages with the mind of the poet, and there is always, we are reading poetry through our own sets of free associations that engage the free associations of the poet who ended up putting those words on the page.
Yes, and it's a beautiful meeting place, I think, when it happens.
Like psychoanalytic encounter in many ways.
Yes, yes, exactly. I mean, it's extraordinary when you, in analysis, kind of know what the patient is going to say next. I don't know if you've had that experience, but it's amazing how it works. And Freud was onto that, I think, that we have our unconscious instrument close to the unconscious instrument of the analysand. And I guess, by having worked on the material for some time, years perhaps, you do kind of know what's coming. When you have a barrage of free associations coming at you, you kind of know that this is going to come next, because you've heard it in the way that you listen over years, right? It's a strange process, psychoanalysis.
Well, I think we could continue this conversation for a very long time, but maybe this is really a good note to end on, given that we do have a limited time within this format.
Thank you very much, both of you. It's been a joy for me.
Thank you very much.